You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. Russia's launched massive drone and missile attacks against Ukraine's energy infrastructure. About a million people have been left without power. At least five were killed. President Volodymyr Zelensky has again appealed to Western countries to provide more air defences. Sarah Rainsford reports from Kyiv.
Dozens of missiles made it through Ukraine's air defences. Kharkiv in the north is totally without power. Even the city's air raid system doesn't work. In Zaporizhia, Ukraine's biggest hydroelectric power station was hit by multiple missiles. The damage is described as significant, though officials say there's no danger of the dam itself being breached. Moscow is calling this attack retribution for Ukrainian strikes on Belgorod and cross-border incursions. What they don't mention is that Russia has been hitting civilian targets here in Ukraine since the very start of the full-scale invasion that Vladimir Putin launched.
Officials in Belgorod say Ukrainian strike has killed a woman and wounded many other people. The governor of the region, Vyacheslav Gudkov, gave more details.
Unfortunately, the morning is not good again. We're under fire again. There are dead, there are wounded. Three healthcare centres and residential buildings were damaged. We will assess the damage and begin rebuilding immediately.
The United States is putting forward a draft resolution which will be voted on at the UN Security Council, calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza linked to the release of hostages. It marks a change of policy for Washington, which has, until now, repeatedly blocked such calls. As part of America's effort to secure a truce, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in Israel. He's been meeting the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. The US wants much more aid to get into Gaza and has warned Israel not to carry out a ground invasion of Gaza's southernmost city, Rafah, where more than a million Palestinians are sheltering. Israel's claimed 800 hectares of land in the occupied West Bank in a move described by activists as the biggest seizure of its kind in decades. The far-right Israeli finance minister declared the area in the northern Jordan Valley state lands. Our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson, reports.
This appears to be a deliberately provocative announcement by Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich. Washington has already made clear that it opposes any more Israeli settlements in the West Bank, saying they threaten the viability of a future independent Palestinian state, the creation of which President Biden believes is necessary for long-term peace. In a stroke, the already difficult job of securing a peace deal for the visiting US Secretary of State has become harder than ever. Israeli media say there are plans to develop hundreds of homes on the seized land in the Jordan Valley.
World News from the BBC.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Arts and Literature Laboratory, Madison's community-based contemporary arts center located at 111 South Livingston Street. Arts and Literature Laboratory houses an art gallery and performance space, a writing center and library, artist studios, and a dedicated education studio, which features classes for all ages. Information about current exhibits, performances, and classes, and how to get involved as a member or volunteer is available at artlitlab.org or on social media at artlitlab.
Thank you. Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. It's March 22. I'm Andy Moore. I have an important announcement just handed to me by Engineer Jim Wilson. We're required to read these by station policy, so I have to read it. I'm sorry for the delay. Spring has been canceled. The National Weather Service redesignated the upper Midwest as winter until further notice. Lakes Mendota and Monona will refreeze by Monday night. The Union Terrace will not open this year. Christmas 2024 has been rescheduled for April 2. Please retrieve your trees from the curb that you dragged out there in January. Everything will be all right, right? Because it was worth it. This is to pay for our sins of those 60-degree days in February. Oh, those were so good. In other March Madness news, the UW-Madison Athletic Director has extended men's basketball coach Greg Gard's contract all the way to the 2037 season. This was announced last night. That is, as long as he gets a team in the top three in the conference and into the postseason. Chris McIntosh says Gard will stay. That seems to be okay with the fans, so he'll stay until at least 2037. The five-seed Badgers play their first-round NCAA playoff game tonight, of course, against the 12-seed James Madison University. That's the same guy Madison is named after. So it'll be the University of Wisconsin-Madison against James Madison University. In addition to being confusing, it's predicted to be an upset, which it won't be. I'm going on the record right now to say, if James Madison wins tonight, it won't be upsetting at all. It certainly won't upset UW Athletic Director Chris McIntosh, who is perfectly content to keep Gard here for another 13 seasons. Okay, we kid, we tease, go Badgers. Actually, we have a UW School of Engineering professor on this morning, speaking of brackets. She'll be here for segment three, and she'll talk about the probabilities involved in winning or losing a March Madness bracket. So get out your pencil and notebook. March Math Madness. That'll be at about 8:45. Dr. Charles Hughes, a pop culture and music scholar from Rhodes College in Memphis, is in the house and is in town for a conference, so we snagged him. Charles has been a past Friday guest, buzz guest, which I think you'll remember once he gets talking. And he's here to talk about Beyonce's entrance into country music and other musical riddles. And that'll be at about half past the hour. Walter Johnson, professor of history and professor of African American studies at Harvard University, is also in Madison, attending the same conference as Charles, among many other topics. He's written about American gun culture, and that's what we'll take up this morning. A full hour indeed. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. The Badgers will actually win tonight by 7, but what do I know? I picked Kentucky to go all the way. Let's get buzzing. Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Jim Wilson, our engineer, slid in here at the very last second. And when I say slide in here, I mean it. As you know, Jim Bicycle's here. Good to see you, Jim. I'm glad you made it. Oh, my goodness. Sorry to bark up our armadillos on the air like that. Segment one. When a scholar like Walter Johnson agrees to come on your program, panic sets in. That's because Dr. Johnson's research and writing covers a lot of ground. But it was his essay in the Boston Review about gun culture that caught my eye. And that's thanks in large part to the guidance of UW-Madison historian Simon Balto, who should get co-producer credit for this morning's show. The piece ran in the Boston Review after the tragic 2018 Parkland, Florida high school shooting. That was gun violence that took 18 lives. If that seems like a long time ago, you may not have noticed all the gun violence since. The gun violence archive defines a mass shooting as a situation in which at least four people were shot and either killed or injured, not including the shooter. By that definition, there were 656 mass shootings last year in the U.S. It turns out that Professor Johnson grew up with guns, surrounded by family members and friends who hunted on lands surrounding his hometown of Columbia, Missouri. His Boston Review essay considered the Parkland shooting through the optics of that not-so-unique American upbringing, but it did so in an extremely unique and candid way. It was included in the 2019 edition of Best American Essays. Harvard University Professor of History and Professor of African American Studies, Walter Johnson, joins us now. Welcome to the Friday Buzz into Madison, Walter, even though you have your suitcase ready to go to the airport.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get out.
I touched on your upbringing and the place guns had in it, but describe that a little bit more yourself.
Well, I grew up in central Missouri. I was my father was a university professor, but he was also somebody who had grown up with hunting culture. He was a very avid hunter, not quite as avid as his parents, who I think by the end of their life, their goal was to kill two of everything on God's green earth. So they traveled all over the world. And that was a part of, I think that was probably the central aspect of my relationship with my father from the time I was probably 7 or 8 up through the time I graduated from high school, was going out to the what we called the rifle range and shooting on the weekends and hunting, you know, going deer hunting 2 weekends every year and goose hunting whenever we could get a spot at the reserve.
You describe gentleness and teacher relationship with your dad in the essay. But when guns take center stage, things get complicated. There was a quote that jumped out, many quotes that jumped out of the essay, Walter, but one read, quote, "My father knew much more about killing than he did about loving."
Yeah, I mean, so you have to imagine this essay written at a distance of almost 20 years from the time my father died in 2001. And trying to reckon with his memory. And, you know, I guess at the time that somebody dies, they in a way, they come back to you in all kinds of different moments. And so some of the moments that I was able to retrieve or remember about my father were moments of gentleness and kindness and understanding. And it did strike me as I went through that process that a lot of those were around hunting or guns. When I got my first gun and him trying to introduce me to that culture. And I think some of his greatest pride in me was around that. And that seemed to me to be both something that I didn't want to abjure, and yet seemed to me to have a kind of a telos in it that was disturbing.
Your essay goes into quite a bit of detail about, you got your first gun when you were 8, but also you reveal how fearsome it was to be engaged in this activity and how you did your best to man up. How is the meaning of manliness so tightly bound to the possession of guns in America, Walter?
Yeah, I mean, all of a sudden there's a set of rules and standards that you have to live up to. And I guess our society is full of rules and standards that you have to live up to. As an 8-year-old or, you know, carrying a shotgun to a goose blind and falling down in the mud and getting the barrel clogged, there's a lot of humiliation in that. And I mean, somewhere in my family kept a hunting record, the Johnson family hunting record, which is 20 volumes of mostly stuff that my grandparents killed, but also has this letter that I wrote after the first time I went goose hunting with my father when I was 8 about just how I, you know, how I had failed in various ways to kind of live up to what I was supposed to do. And I think that that memory, that feeling is still with me, you know, in the sense of where I guess all of the times when you feel like you haven't quite done what you're supposed to do or should have done, that, you know, is resonant with that moment. And it's a way that I can still feel my father and my, you know, my childhood within me. And that's a powerful feeling.
It was really a priority for you to succeed in the field with your dad, it seemed. It's such a priority that, and there are some very humorous moments in the essay too, such a priority that all was forgiven when you nearly blasted people's heads off and shot crap out, you know, in the basement. And you weren't a very safe sportsman, but it seemed that you were forgiven because this is the way it's going to be and you're going to get this right and this is what this family does. But that was some pressure almost, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, I was a menace with a gun in my hand. You know, I mean, I'm a menace with a cup of coffee in my hand, but and that translated. So I did have a number of accidents, you know, premature discharges when I was in the woods, and I think that there was in that a sense of like not having lived up to the code. But also, you know, it's actually interesting that you see it as a set of moments of forgiveness and reintegration, because I hadn't thought of it that way. I think of it as moments of exposure and mortification of a kind of an ongoing inability to comply. And the fact that you see it as a set of moments of forgiveness actually makes me reflect on it in a slightly different way than I have before.
It all seems to have its roots in manliness, as we've been examining. And there are so many parts to our culture that ask boys to be a part of that. Here we are talking about bracketology and March Madness, we all know a lot of families where, by God, if you have a boy, you're gonna play basketball, you're gonna play baseball, you're gonna play football, and you're gonna listen to the coach, and you're gonna walk it off. In your opinion, Walter, and we were talking sports before we came on the air. In your opinion, how does that propel some of the issues that we're talking about that turns into violence off the field?
Oh man, I don't even want to go there. You know, I'm afraid that my 11-year-old will grow into an alienated man and write a essay called, you know, Youth Soccer in the Family. So that makes me want to say a couple things. The first thing is that I guess it's important to say, just in response to that, there's a lot of this that I haven't myself transcended, and there's a lot of ways that we all make peace with parts of our society or parts of ourselves that we might not, that we might not, if in a cooler moment, identify as the best parts of ourselves. What I will say is, I think the gun thing is a little bit different, although perhaps related to some of the things around athletics and the obsession with athletics, particularly around upper middle class people and youth soccer and all these other things. I think that the gun culture, you know, rests upon and is occasionally cognizant of a genocide. And I think that if you trace up the history of the Second Amendment, the history of the militias, the history of white people in arms in the United States, that was about conquest. And that was about the maintenance of racial rule, whether that was enslavement or whether that was conquest. And it's my feeling that exists today as a kind of a political unconscious. And so some of what I was trying to do in the essay, and some of what I try to do as I reflect on that, is to try not simply to say that and condemn it, but to say that and recognize the way that people's affective relationships, the love that people have for one another, the way that people are able to express that love, the type of forgiveness that you just tuned me into, are connected to that legacy and how vexed that is. And that helps me then understand the kind of anaphylactic reaction that people have when asked, when told that their gun culture is unhealthy or inappropriate, because their gun culture is in many ways the way that they relate to their loved ones. And yet it is, traces back to this history of genocide.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Walter Johnson, a professor of history at Harvard University. Walter, you use the word transcended. Let's go there. There's some transcendence that you reveal in the essay, as we have talked about just now. Your father devoted to hunting all the way to and somewhat related to his death. Your shared gun and hunting experiences were true stories that you say you regaled your fancy academic friends at Princeton with. In your essay, you revealed some shame in the aftermath of amusing your peers with those tales. If talk about that shame, if that's the right word for it, or at least self-consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll tell a little story in that it's always seemed to me a little bit like an episode in a novel that Robert Penn Warren wrote called A Place to Come To. And he talks about being, the character, the main character, the protagonist in that essay is a child from Alabama who's gone to the University of Chicago to study classics. And we'll tell this story over and over again about how his father died in Alabama. And the story is his father's driving a mule cart drunk and falls off the front of the mule cart, gets run over by his own mule cart. And he would tell this story for laughs. And then all of a sudden one night, and that to me is the feeling that I had, that I had been playing something for laughs that was tragic. And that I had been doing that, sort of selling up my own past in order to fit in with people who would never understand it.
From there, after that reveal, the essay reveals what you didn't share with them, something you call, in a very effective but poetic way, the undertow. And that comes in the form of a story about your friend Virgil and his dad. Can you give us the thumbnail story of that, and then we'll try to tie this all together?
Yeah, well, this is a guy who lived across the street from me, and his family were big, big, big gunners. And, had a machine gun in the house and a shooting range in the basement. When they moved out, I think my parents found out they had been shooting, like, at a target right next to the gas pipe. So it was, it's only by the fact that they were excellent at what they were doing that Columbia, Missouri exists at all today. But I remember this one incident that, and I always admired them. I always admired him in particular, because he seemed to be a kid who had and was good at all the things that I was sort of mediocre at, and, had all the cool stuff, and, he had a dirt bike, and all this different, an actual motorcycle dirt bike. And then one time I saw him getting punished by his father, and his father had him out on the front porch, hands up against the wall, legs spread, kicking him in the ass with a cowboy boot, and just over and over and over. And that image has stuck with me. Again, the way that the sense of admiration that I had for this child's mastery of the code, and then the way that moment revealed to me aspects of the code that I hadn't even encountered.
The price that he was paying for trying to make that code work, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's fair.
This pivots to the conclusion of the essay, a conclusion that I want to share with the listeners as we close here, in two passages from the essay itself. I'll read the first, and then I ask you to read the second. I'm reading now from Walter Johnson's essay in the Boston Review. My memories and my stories, I've sadly concluded in later life, lead inevitably toward the machine gun hidden in my friend's father's study or lying next to my father's easy chair, the heady and uniquely American blend of martial culture, white paranoia, toxic masculinity, which makes stories of so many U.S. families and childhoods illegible without guns, possesses an instant teleology, a sense that all this perceived threat is leading us to someplace inevitable, a battlefield on which one will not stand a chance of surviving without a gun, which then leads Walter into writing this passage that I think is a nice, if that's the right words, summary for sort of where he's come. Go ahead, Walter.
When I hear the NRA people going on about how guns are just tools, I think absolutely, you're right, guns are tools. Tools for making emotionally stunted men feel whole. Tools for guiding lonely boys along bloody pathways to becoming violent men. Tools for spreading the fearful fantasy of the coming race war. Tools for inflaming urban areas and rural states and making the argument for more cops and more prisons. Tools for reproducing white male dominance and supremacy. Tools for white male parthenogenesis.
Thank you. Walter Johnson, how can this enormous ship of American violence be righted?
I think it goes back to the fear, and I think that the fear, the lack of a sense of safety that people feel in our society, and by that I mean prosperous white people, people who are actually quite safe. But I think that that fear resides in the inequality in our society. I think that people who imagine that they need guns to protect themselves recognize, even if only on an unconscious level, that they're living on top of a sea of inequality. And so for me, the answer lies less in a program like banning assault weapons, which I favor. It's you know, assault weapons don't exist to do anything except for kill people. But that's an incomplete solution. That's a partial solution. If it's not an AR-15, it's going to be a 45 with a extended magazine. The point for me is to address the sense of inequality and the sense of injustice that resides at the heart of our society, and it's only then, I think, that people who believe that they are besieged, even as they are dominating the society, will begin to put down their arms and try and extend a hand, and to live in a better way and more right relationship with their humanity and with their own families.
Dr. Walter Johnson, thank you so much for making time for us on the Friday Buzz. Safe travels back to Boston.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
Walter Johnson is professor of history and a professor of African American studies at Harvard University. The essay we've been talking about is called Guns in the Family. It can be found in the archives of the Boston Review online at bostonreview.net, along with a lot of other essays that I was able to pour through this week. It's well worth the visit, bostonreview.net. Okay, you know, we pride ourselves on top-notch scholarship here on the Friday Buzz. When we return, we'll visit with another professor, this one a cultural anthropologist from Memphis who has some great and fun insight into Beyoncé's reach into country music. You're listening to the March Sadness edition of Greg Gard's Career in Madison. Just kidding, they'll win tonight, WRT FM 89.9, WRTFM.org in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:30.
wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman.
Or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
Hi, my name is Vicki Kenyon. I'm your host for this week's Access Hour on WORT Madison, and I am a connector. I have always loved connecting people with one another and connecting people to resources. As I dove into my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to homeownership in ways that the rest of our country does. I want to change that. My aim is to make a significant positive impact on queer and trans homeownership here in Dane County. So, after a lot of networking and a lot of planning, I gathered a team of four other professionals and launched a free educational series that provides resources and answers to questions around home ownership in an inclusive, welcoming, and safe space. And now, we bring our knowledge to you here. On this week's Access Hour, my team and I will be here talking Homeownership 101 and answering your questions live.
It's the Friday Clock Buzz. I'm Andy Moore. It's Friday. It's 8:35. That means it's time for your musical live music plans to start gelling, to start coming into focus. We're going to help you with that as we do every Friday at this time. And in order to do that, we have to first play Encore's Picks Disclaimer. Here's Jim Wilson with the Encore's Picks Disclaimer. And I think there's something else on your mind.
Yeah, I have to apologize to our listening audience about the snow this weekend. I did put my winter bike away last weekend.
You did.
And it's all my fault.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Encore's picks are not influenced by any outside entities. Encore consults with an advisory board of one, Encore Malhotra. The cost of admission to any recommended show is of no concern to Encore, nor the price of beer, nor the cleanliness of the venue restrooms. Encore has one goal and one goal only in the delivery of Encore's picks, for you to have a kick-ass musical experience. Encore's Picks is a trademark of the multinational corporation DJ Spin Cycle. All copy and trade therein is solely possessed. Here's Encore Malhotra!
Happy spring, Madison. We are having a whale of a time here in studio. And tonight, March 22nd, at the Rubinia, awesome tapes from Africa. What? Awesome tapes from Africa. You get that right. Awesome tapes from Africa is a label and music coming. Evan Woodward, Boomback Joe opening tonight at Robinia. March 23rd, Crystal Corner, Lozar's Ben Tantana, Back Issues, Hazy Shades, yeah. March 26th at the Overture, John Mellencamp. March 27th at the Orpheum, Steve Hackett, Genesis fame. Well, some heavy hitters coming in, and tomorrow, yours truly, DJ Spin Cycle at Pan Africa.
All right. Thank you, Encore. Thank you. Let's listen to a little Beyonce, and then we'll come back and we'll talk with Charles Hughes.
This ain't Texas. Alexis, and throw your keys up. Hey. Stick around, round, 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 round.
Stick around.
And I'll be damned if I can't slow dance with you. Come pour some sugar on me, honey, too. It's a real live boogie and a real live hold down. Don't be a
your bitch, come take it to
Let's keep that playing just for a little bit under me, if that's possible. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz, co-produced this morning by UW Madison history professor and Butler University basketball fan Simon Balto. That is Beyonce. I think we have it still. Maybe not. And we'll get to her in a moment. But first, I'm looking across the table from a guy who terrorized the city of Madison before he left it a better place. Rhodes College. How's that for a save? Rhodes College professor Charles Hughes earned his doctorate here. And I can't tell you what it was in, but subsequent to all that, I know
history.
That Charles has the grooviest syllabus of any professor alive. He studies and writes about pop culture, country music, and pro wrestling. Charles Hughes, welcome back to the show, this time in person.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. It's always a pleasure to be here. And I have not been in the WRT studios in many, many years, so this is an even better, even bigger pleasure today.
Let's jump right into music, the appropriation word, mm-hmm. which we're going to try to come to sure. terms with, and Beyonce. You and I were enjoying just that little 20-second cut. We were talking even about the selection of instruments. Mm-hmm. There was a gourd banjo in that. Talk about it musically. Mm-hmm. But before you do that, and I'm sorry to hit you with two questions at once, but Beyonce and country music, you're a plugged-in guy. Did you see that coming?
You know, in a sense, I didn't. I would say that, but in a sense, I did. You know, and Beyonce has... I mean, she's from Houston. She's Texan. She has been embracing increasingly her Texanness. Actually, the person who I think was first, at least that I heard talking about this, is another UW PhD, brilliant historian named Tawana Steptoe, who back in like the mid-2000s was talking about Beyonce as a Houston artist and the way that her mix was very much from that particular region and that particular culture. And actually, she's written about this. And so in a sense, I did, especially, you know, she had the song Daddy Lessons on Lemonade that is very, very country. She performed that song with the Chicks at the CMAs, which apparently, because of the backlash to her appearance, was one of the things that inspired her to make this new record. So she's always been Texas, and if you're going to be Texas and you're going to be Houston, country is either going to be part of your mix or it very well could be. But I will say, it still felt like this kind of astonishing moment to have her make this announcement, and very much, frankly, of a moment that, you know, these larger conversations about black country have been going on so much over the last few years with all kinds of great artists and writers. So yes and no in terms of the announcement. But in terms of the instruments, you know, that song Texas Hold'em with the gourd banjo, yeah. that is played by Rhiannon Giddens. And, you know, the fact that she's not only working with banjo and with other kind of line dancing sounds and other things, but specifically using Rhiannon Giddens, the brilliant musician and educator and composer and, you know, all the things, that suggests to me that, you know, she's really trying to think of this album, or at least think of some of it in some way, what we've heard so far, as being a commentary on the broader conversation.
It's so cool, that forethought, that intellectual mm-hmm. creativity, it is suggested so strongly. Yeah. You touched on this. I know that American country music in all of its ways is a product created as much by black Americans as white. Still, Beyonce seems to, and here's the word, appropriate it, maybe reappropriate it, mm-hmm. to take it hostage, to make it her own, and then set it back down on the ground. Is that what she did?
I mean, I wouldn't say she appropriated it, other than the sense that, you know, she definitely, this is a move into country music in a way that's much more sustained than she's done before. But I do think it's reappropriation is actually not a bad way to think of it, in the sense of, like, you know, she as a black artist, and, you know, country music is rooted in black music as much as it is rooted in anything. Black musicians have made country music and influenced country music throughout every generation and iteration of the music. And country music, although it is primarily identified with white artists, has always incorporated black sounds, including black popular music. It's not just about the roots and influences like the blues or whatever. It's also about, you know, country in the 50s and 60s incorporating R&B, country in the 21st century incorporating hip hop. So I think when we're thinking about incorporating or appropriating different kinds of music, what I think is essential in this conversation is that you know, the country music has always been about black music. It's just not always or often or even far little about black artists. So I don't think she's taking it hostage. I think she's demonstrating her engagement with it. Now, I will say that, you know, Beyonce as this kind of cross-genre transcendent pop star, mm-hmm. I think this is really interesting, and I think she has just as much legitimacy to make this music as anyone else. But I also think that what's interesting about this moment and what I hope happens with it is that we don't act like Beyonce is either the first or the only person to do this.
Gotcha.
There are quite literally hundreds in past and present black artists who are just as interesting, just as innovative, and who are very much working in country music and grounded in country music specifically. So I don't think she's doing anything other than a really interesting artistic project that I hope is as good as I think it maybe could be. But I also think that what I hope this moment does is that it shines a light on all of the artists, and again, today and in the past, who are black artists and specifically black women who have not gotten the opportunities in country music mm-hmm. that they deserve and who are very much trying to do that and are, quite frankly, are the creative center of country music.
And I think that's what I was getting at when I used that word hostage. Yeah. To my mind, it was a very deliberate intellectual act, a proud one. Mm-hmm. We're this music much as you are or anyone is. And how about some of it? Here, have it.
Right.
If you just jumped in, I'm visiting with Dr. Charles Hughes, someone we love to visit with on Fridays. Charles is the director of the Turley Center at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to make you put on your professor hat.
Okay.
Dr. Hughes, because I don't want to leave this this complicated word appropriation too far behind in this conversation. So here's the discipline. They call it a discipline, right, Professor? Mm-hmm. If you're going to teach a semester on the word appropriation, what is that syllabus summary on the first day say?
Sure. Well, you know, the thing about appropriation when we're thinking about music, and it is certainly a term that a lot of people use, and I'm glad we're talking about it more than perhaps we were in the past. The thing about appropriation, you know, musicians are always bringing in other sounds. It's not about that musicians are trying to kind of incorporate other things into their music. Where appropriation, I think, becomes something to think about is that what we're really talking about here is a history of both economic and cultural ownership, and thinking about the ways that, in this case, black musicians have not only not benefited materially from music created that they created or that was created within their communities, and often seen that benefit expropriated to white people, right? White people using black resources and not compensating properly is a central narrative of American history within music and without. And the other side of that, though, is a kind of cultural ownership. So when we talk about appropriation, we are talking about the material, who's making the money, and we all also, I think, need to be thinking about who is getting credited with being an innovator as opposed to an influence. Mm. Black musicians are almost always talked about as being these sort of wellsprings of musical influence for white artists, even though black musicians, of course, are not only doing things themselves, but are also incorporating white sound. So when we talk about appropriation, it's not just about the sound. It has to be about who is benefiting from it and how do those benefits economically and culturally play into larger structural inequities in American life. It's not just about does this include certain sounds. It is about who is benefiting from them and how are they playing into the cultural narrative.
Jim Wilson, we're getting ready to play a clip and to help Charles make a point here with this word appropriation. And I think this might be a positive application of what we're talking about. Jim Wilson, let's listen to Luke Combs' version in Fast Car.
You got a fast car, and I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better.
Yeah, Luke Combs, versioning Fast Car, versioning a keyword here. Charles, mm-hmm. What else is going on there?
So, yeah, I mean, this was obviously a huge hit last summer, and it was a lot of conversation about Luke Combs and Tracy Chapman and Tracy Chapman's benefiting or not from Luke Combs' version, Luke Combs having such success. And what I think is really important here is that, first of all, the first thing I wanted to know after I heard the song, I wanted to make sure that Tracy Chapman owned her publishing, because one of the stories that is in American history that is absolutely vital to understanding these conversations is that oftentimes, and it's not just about race, but it is often about race, black artists don't profit from the success that white artists or others may have with their own songs. So that's number one, is that Tracy Chapman is deservedly getting benefits from this. She also is being kind of re-entered into a cultural conversation. I was really impressed with the performance at the Grammys because Luke Combs did what I think a lot of white folks should do in those situations, which is just quite literally step aside and let her have her song. But also I would say that the thing about that version, which is a perfectly fine version, I think it's actually pretty good. I love that he didn't change the pronouns, the gender of the pronouns, which I don't think people are talking about. It's kind of interesting. But also, the question that I immediately had, or the thing that I said that I think makes these conversations important, it's not about Luke Combs. My question was, okay, Luke Combs, that's cool, and he's obviously very explicit about trying to honor Tracy Chapman and bring her back into the conversation. Not that she needs country music, but, you know, good for her. My question was, there are a lot of black artists, especially black women, in Nashville or in country music who not only could do that version, but have done that version. The Black Opry Review, yes, which has played Madison a couple times, they used to close with a group version of Fast Car years ago. So my question is not about Luke Combs, and I think appropriation is not just about white artists doing black music. It's about, why do all the black artists who could do this, why are they never going to get the support for their versions of Fast Car? That, to me, is the deeper conversation. And it's not about Luke Combs. It is about the broader power dynamic.
You may have answered what is going to have to be my final question. We had another example we were going to play, and I apologize.
No worries. We don't need to hear that one. That's not a good example.
Okay. Actually, you know, I'm like where this is going, and I know what you're saying. But I'd like for you to leave our audience, Charles, with some advice. Advice to listeners of pop music. You gave us a lot to think about in the last 10 or 12 minutes. How can we be smarter consumers of music of all genres in the context of these cultural issues?
I think the big thing I can say is to try to listen as widely as possible and try to hear the artists in these spaces, whether it's other black country artists who Beyonce is hopefully going to bring attention to, or whether it's artists who white artists do versions of their songs. Like, explore those things and listen. And also, you know, try to support the work of artists who don't have the resource backing of a Beyonce or a Luke Combs, and just, you know, continue to listen to the communities of people who are telling us about all these great artists that we have to choose from.
Charles Hughes, thanks for joining us live and in person on the Friday Buzz. Safe travels back to Memphis.
Hey, thank you. Anytime.
Thank you so much. Charles Hughes is a pop culture genius and the director of the Turley Center at Rhodes College in Memphis. Okay, we move from music to NCAA basketball. Up next, a UW engineering professor takes us to school with the impossible bracket math of March Madness. You're listening to BRT FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:50. I'm gonna give you my love. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. We got about 9 minutes left, and that's enough time to ask this question. What's the difference between your chances to win the Powerball lottery and picking out the perfect March Madness bracket? Why don't we ask a UW-Madison engineering professor who's an expert in math modeling and sports analytics. Laura Albert joins us from Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky, where paramutual horse racing has just begun for the spring meet. Kidding! Professor Albert is on the phone and here in Madison. I'm sorry I couldn't resist that.
No problem. Thanks
for
having me.
Are you there? Okay. It just seems like if I had that kind of engineering prowess, I would be at the racetrack, but I'm sorry if that's inappropriate. How are the odds different between the chances to pick a perfect March Madness bracket and winning this month's Powerball?
It's much easier to win Powerball, which is kind of hard to believe.
Huh.
Picking brackets is really challenging, and following the analytics and doing a better job on each pick can make it a little bit more manageable. But there are about 9.2 quintillion ways to fill out a bracket. And that's a lot. That's more, more
ways than there are. It's impossible to imagine that number. Would you say it again?
9.2 quintillion.
To make a perfect bracket.
Yes. I also was not aware that quintillion was a number, but it's a really large one.
It sure is. Numbers and athletics have always been in the same room, haven't they? It's kind of what defines competition, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of fun to study the numbers if you're someone like me.
What do they tell you?
Yeah, a lot of things. In particular, we're looking at the bracket. You have different seeds. We look at different rankings for the teams, and I like to create my own rankings with numbers and game outcomes. We also have the seeds that are assigned to the teams in the tournament, the 1 through 16. And that provides a lot of structure that we can see in the tournament as well, because the seed tells you which team, what their path looks like to the Final Four. And we can look historically at teams that are 1 seeds and how far they make it into the tournament versus, say, an 11 seed or 16 seed. That gives us a lot of information when we're predicting what could happen in the tournament.
You're obviously a statistics fan. Are you a sports fan?
Yes, I am.
Did you do a bracket sheet?
I fill out a bracket every year. This year I've been pretty busy. I didn't do as much research as I would have liked, but I always study the numbers throughout the year.
Yes, and how do you do, generally speaking? It sounds like that you do sort of practice what you preach with regards to applying those statistical data into your bracketology. How well do you do?
Yeah, I do better than average, I would say, over time. There is a lot of luck that's involved in brackets, because most of us that participate in a bracket pool, there's an exponential increase in the number of points for each round. So what that means is a lot of luck is involved. And but in many years, it's by using the numbers, I can finish, either win the pool or finish near the top.
Really?
Yeah.
And that means you sound like you can do that with some confidence.
Yeah, some years are easier than others, and so last year was not a good year if you use the math, because there were just so many upsets, and it was a very unlikely Final Four team. But most years, if you look out on the average, they are a little bit more predictable, and it's, you know, be able to see the pattern, like, you know, a typical Final Four has 2 1 seeds, a 2 seed, and maybe a 3 or a 4 seed.
If you're just joining us, I'm sorry, I spoke right over you. I'm sorry about that. Go ahead.
That's okay. I was going to say that it's really hard to predict which 2 1 seeds and 2 seeds and will be in the Final Four, but the math will tell us those patterns, and it really helps give us the best chance to win our bracket.
Laura Albert is a UW-Madison professor of industrial and systems engineering. Laura, I know our listeners would it's too late for this year, but give us a little bit more insight and some actual advice about how one should pay attention to numbers when they choose, rather than to matters of the heart.
Sure. And here's a couple of things. So I just gave some clues about the Final Four. The overall winner of the tournament has been a 1 seed about 63% of the time. Hmm. So about 2/3 of the tournament, a 1 seed is going to win. And the other 64 teams win the other 37% of the time. So even though there are a lot of teams in the tournament, not that many teams typically have a chance of winning at all. And there's so many points in those later rounds in the tournament that usually picking one of the top teams makes a lot of sense in the tournament.
As a statistician, it must be pleasing in some ways to see math come into the mainstream culture once a year the way it does during March. Is that something that gives your business a little bounce?
Oh, absolutely. I think math is useful for so many things, but it is definitely relevant this 1 week. And, you know, as an industrial engineer and somebody who's very comfortable with the numbers, you know, year round, I'm interested in designing systems that perform very well in an uncertain environment. And that's not unlike what we're trying to do when we're filling out a bracket.
Do you mind if I ask you, I guess I'm asking you, even if you do, I'm sorry to put you on the spot, about who you picked to win the tournament?
I filled out a couple brackets, and I picked Houston to win it all in my first bracket, and then I picked UConn in the second one. Mm-hmm. Some years I do a little bit more research than others, but I try to look at the strength of the brackets. The selection committee tries to balance the strength of all the four tournaments, but when I look at a lot of the math-based rankings, I can see that some of the brackets are a little tougher than others, and I thought UConn's region was a little bit tough.
It's a real corn maze. Professor Laura Albert, thank you so much for joining us here on March Madness Eve, so to speak, and on the Friday Buzz. Have a great weekend. Laura Albert is a UW-Madison professor of industrial systems engineering, and we are going to pull this show up to the curb. We covered a lot of territory this morning, and I want to thank Walter Johnson, Harvard history professor, who started off our hour with his insight on American gun culture. Dr. Charles Hughes, who's in Madison from Memphis, talking about Beyonce and country music and cultural and musical appropriation in a very deep manner. Thank you, Charles. Always great to see you. And then Laura Albert, putting all of the March mathness into perspective. Elliot LeBrun, Jim Wilson, Ankur Malhotra, thank you for all the hand-holding as you do each Friday. Next Friday morning on the 8 o'clock buzz, Wendy Schneider is here to talk about her documentary Angels in the Dust that will be part of the Wisconsin Film Festival. The Insurgent Radio Kiosk is next, followed by Chris Powers and the great bluegrass show Mud Acres. You're listening to WRT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin, WRTFM.org online. Have a great damn weekend. Aloha, kamaaina!
Bird Note. To our ear, the haunting song of the hermit thrush is musical, even ethereal. To another hermit thrush, the song signals a male is laying claim to a territory and seeking a mate. Spend time around hermit thrushes in a mountain forest in summer, and you're also likely to hear them make other sounds, such as or hermit thrushes, like other songbirds, broadcast a variety of calls. Call notes can signal many things: alarm at a predator, or aggression toward a rival. Or they may simply maintain contact between members of a pair or flock. Black-capped chickadees sing a plaintive whistled song and make a call that gives the bird its name. The chickadee call serves different purposes in different contexts and is but one of a dozen in the bird's repertoire. American goldfinch males sing a bright, bubbly song and nearly always call in flight with a sweet four-syllable. Like to tell us what birds are singing and calling around your home? Find us at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Tomorrow, the BIPOC Birding Club will host its third annual Woodcock Walk. You're invited to join and search for these cool little birds as they peent and do their quirky and elaborate courtship fights called sky dances. BIPOC Birding Club events are open to all BIPOC.